I think we'll get started. It's appropriate time. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Alonzo Plow. I'm Vice President for Research Evaluation and Chief Science Officer at Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our panel, and you'll be hearing from them in just a few minutes. I have to make the first, before we get going, the following disclosure statement. That I and all of my fellow panelists, Dr. Georges Benjamin, Mr. Kevin Washington, Dr. Karen Remley, and Dr. Kenneth Anderson, all of us have not had personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation during the last 12 months. And I'd also like to disclose that I'm really happy to be here. This conference marks a milestone for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, one that we've been eagerly anticipating for quite some time. Last year, the foundation unveiled a vision of America where we strive together to build a culture of health. And that's a culture that enables all in our diverse society to lead healthier lives now and for generations to come. You may have read about this culture of health vision in the President's message and the Commission to Build a Healthier American report. And here at the APHA annual meeting, we are officially launching this new framework for mobilizing a culture of health, turning this vision into action. And we consider the public health community to be a key partner in building a culture of health. You've been ahead of the curve. You know that when it comes to improving health in America, we are all in this together. You know that building a culture of health is all about partnerships. So today, I'm going to introduce you to this new action framework that we developed to spark more integration and integrated collaborations. And after I speak for a few minutes, I'm going to turn the mic over to our great partners here so you can see how their organizations are already driving toward a movement to build a culture of health, forging innovative collaborations, and seeing promising signs of progress. And then we'll open the floor to questions, and we really encourage you to take part in what I hope is going to be a dynamic discussion. And again, as let me formally introduce our panelists, Dr. Georges Benjamin, who you all know from the American Public Health Association, Mr. Kevin Washington, CEO of YMCA USA, Dr. Karen Remley, CEO of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and Dr. Kenneth Anderson, COO of the Health Research and Educational Trust. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is really one of many organizations working toward the common cause of improving health and well-being in America. And we want to help organizations that have not traditionally seen themselves as health-related to find their way to join this movement. So, over the last year, many of my colleagues and I have been sharing this vision for building a culture of health with people across the country and actually around the world. We've spoken with educators, policymakers, providers, researchers, community organizers, business leaders, and many, many others. And we're really happy the response has been overwhelmingly enthusiastic. And I think many people agree that the time has come for this country to make a seismic shift in the way we define and approach health. As you know, a culture of health is an essential part of everything we do. It's the bedrock of personal fulfillment, the backbone of prosperity. And in a culture of health, business and industry leaders know that well-being boosts the bottom line, and they do their part to keep employees and their communities vital and productive. Doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals work as partners with their patients, and care is as much about actively promoting health as treating illness. In a culture of health, we also recognize that health and well-being can be greatly influenced by complex social factors, where we live, where we work, the soundness and safety of our neighborhoods, and the strength and resilience of our families and communities. You know, one of our grantees summed it up very nicely. A culture of health is a society-wide understanding that everything comes back to health. Good health and well-being are essential to the enjoyment and fulfillment of all other rights and responsibilities and activities of daily life. Let me also add that the word health can mean many things to many people, and a culture of health respects and honors the diversity in our population and the importance of our family and ethnic traditions. And we also recognize that building a national movement toward better health is not a short-term initiative. It's going to require a cultural shift that may take a generation or more to achieve. And it'll take time, determination, and the input of many. And we're going to be looking to you, particularly our public health colleagues, for input and for inspiration. Because you're on the front lines every day, and we're counting on you to share your successes and your challenges and to drive the momentum for this national movement. We all know that in America, we're at a pivotal moment of change regarding the health of our people, a moment of really great urgency, and that's been echoed through many presentations at our meetings. And again, here's some of the numbers about that, some that have been presented previously, I'm sure, in other sessions, and we're in the opening session. But despite the recent slowdown in spending, America's overall health expenditures are unparalleled internationally at nearly $3 trillion annually. That's 18% of our GNP spent on health care. But what do we have to show for it? Compared to other people at similar high-income countries, Americans live shorter, sicker lives. American adults over 50 have a higher prevalence of cardiovascular and other chronic diseases. And over one-third of American children are overweight or obese. These kids have a real chance of becoming the first generation to live sicker and die younger than their parents. And what's more, nearly one-fifth of all Americans live in low-income neighborhoods that make it hard to be healthy, places with high rates of crime and pollution, places with inadequate housing and limited access to nutritional food, places with a paucity of job opportunities. You know, in America, your zip code at birth may be as important as your genetic code in predicting how well and how long you live. Take a look at this map of the rail system here in Chicago. I think the Chicagoans call this the L, is that right? Okay. Now, babies born in the downtown Loop District can expect to live to be 85 years old. But if you happen to live just 8 miles south in Washington Park, where the unemployment rate is 23% and 39% of households live below the poverty level, you're likely to die up to 16 years sooner. Now, I could show you maps of Atlanta, Las Vegas, Seattle, lots of other places where this contrast is as high as 15 or even 20 years. So a nation that prides itself as being a land of opportunity, health disparities as pronounced as these are just simply not acceptable. Addressing these challenges will require individuals, institutions, and sectors to think and work differently. You know, for too long, our nation has defined being healthy as simply not being sick. And we have largely addressed health issues in parallel tracks with limited cross-sector collaboration. But I think the good news as a nation, we are facing up to the fact that we need to change directions. And the music is a little irritating, but I'm just going to keep talking through it. That's okay. We have started looking for new roads. Ones that will broaden our concept of health and lead us to better and more integrated ways of improving it. Over the past 18 months, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, in collaboration with the RAND Corporation, has developed an action framework to accelerate an integrated course of action by many individuals, communities, and organizations. Now, this framework is drawn from rigorous research, and I would say also rigorous listening. We receive valuable input from more than 1,000 experts, partners, community members, focus group participants, and global leaders. And everyone who worked on this project has been driven by one question: what is holding our nation back from the health that we aspire to? And what we discovered that as a nation, we are not addressing the interdependence and many social, economic, and environmental factors of health and well-being. You know, one sector alone cannot resolve these factors. But the question remains, what areas of action should we work toward? How should our actions connect to one another? And what specific measures will gauge improvement? We've addressed these questions by proposing an action framework grounded in four interconnected action areas that show health and well-being as the sum of many parts. And you can see that on the slide. Making health a shared value, fostering cross-sector collaboration to improve well-being, creating healthier, more equitable communities, and strengthening integration of health services and systems. Together, these action areas are intended to achieve an outcome of improved population health and well-being. And I'd like to point out one really important thing about this framework. Equity and opportunity are overarching themes, because in order to truly build the culture of health, no one can be left behind. So this action framework will guide the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's work and investments over the next 20 years, and it's intended to be a broader framework for the nation, including actions that are not necessarily funded by us. The action framework was designed to build on the energy and legacy of those who have worked in the health area for many years, but it also opens the doors to new allies, especially those sectors and organizations who haven't seen themselves as having much to do with health until now. And rather than imposing the Foundation's definition of a culture of health upon others, we want this framework to provide entry points that resonate with the goals and values of many individuals, communities, and organizations. That's why we call it a framework and not a model. A model implies something that's formulaic, fixed, final, a blueprint that should be emulated. A framework speaks to a built-in fluidity, an opportunity to utilize the structure, personalize it, and run with it. Now, I'm going to provide you a brief overview of the action framework, but I'm not going to dive into every detail. Instead, you'll hear in just a few minutes how our panelists within their organizations are building on this framework and bringing it to life in exciting ways. So, action area one, which is about making health a shared value. This action places our nation's values and expectations about health front and center. It emphasizes the importance of achieving and maintaining and really reclaiming health as a shared priority. When we do that, we fuel a greater sense of community, an increased demand for healthy places and practices, and a stronger belief that individual actions can make a difference in the well-being of others. And now each action area, as you see in the chart, has a corresponding set of drivers. Here in action area one, you see those drivers are mindset and expectation, sense of community, and civic engagement. And these drivers are the engine of the action framework, and they provide a set of long-term priorities we hope individuals and organizations across sectors will focus on, both nationally and at the community level. And together, the action area and drivers create the key building blocks of the action framework that will remain constant over time. Now, across the action framework, we have selected 41 national evidence-based measures, rigorously selected as points of assessment and engagement. No way to do a 41-measure talk. You wouldn't want to really sit through that. But outside, you have, if you don't have it already, a listing of those 41 measures. And you can reference that full list on the handout. The measures are in the column on the right. The measures were selected, and they were based on the availability of national data, application across the entire lifespan, and really to focus on the upstream drivers and broad determinants related to health outcomes, the ability to engage multiple audiences, particularly those audiences that aren't usually in health, with an overarching concern on measures that speak to our concern with equity. And by design, the measures are not limited to traditional health indicators, and they encourage us to think of health in broader ways, incorporating all aspects of well-being. And the measures will illustrate progress and will evolve over time to keep pace with ongoing and changing conditions. Now let's move on to Action Area 2, which focuses on fostering cross-sector collaboration and improving well-being. Now, this means breaking down silos that separate improving health from the work of education, business, transportation, community development, and other historically, quote-unquote, non-health sectors that form an important piece of the health puzzle. Progress in cross-sector collaboration has been made in recent years, but we really need to ensure that more partnerships can reach their full potential and impact. And these kind of cross-sectoral collaborations must become the new normal if we're going to tackle some of our urgent and compelling health challenges. Moving to Action Area 3, creating healthier, more equitable communities. The goal of this action area is to encourage communities to fulfill their greatest health potential by improving the environment in which residents live, learn, work, and play. Now, we've made strides in creating healthier environments. We must ensure that community settings support overall well-being and extend to upstream influences on health. And just to be really clear on this, the action framework requires a strong public covenant to make healthy choices every day. But it really emphasizes that in order to make those choices, we need more equitable environments that make those choices possible. Now, lastly, action area 4 focuses on strengthening integration of health services and systems. This action area aims to strengthen a system of coordinated care that integrates and better balances medical treatment with public health and social services. Work we have been supporting in this area will build off last year's commission report recommendations that health systems acknowledge and systematically address the reality of their patients' lives that directly impact outcomes and cost. And this area requires examining the role of healthcare as part of a larger network and deepening connections with a broader set of partners in public health and social services. By improving access, consumer experience and quality, and balance and integration, we can build a culture of health that empowers both patients and providers. I want to note that one of the measures in this area is access to public health. Specifically the percentage of the population that is served by comprehensive public health systems. So, if the nation makes progress in these 4 integrated areas, we believe that we will approach an outcome of improved population health, well-being, and equity. And the outcome measures will help us gauge long-term improvements amongst individual caregivers and communities. So these outcomes encompass improvements in our health the nation has long sought to attain, and building a culture of health is intended to support a trajectory of well-being throughout the lifespan. Well, I know this is a lot to take in, and thanks for staying with me. For an in-depth look at the action framework, you can visit the new Culture of Health website, which just went live at the conference. The website's intended to encourage dialogue and input regarding the framework and the set of measures. And so you can get more information on the website, our 30 sentinel communities that we're going to be following for the next 5 to 10 years, all of that, go to the website and you can get information about this. So, moving to our panelists. Without real-world examples and tangible signs of progress, a culture of health is just a vision. So I would like to invite our panel to share how their organizations have been mobilizing a culture of health vision into action and how this new framework resonates with their work. So again, to all the panelists, thanks for joining us today. I will move up and turn the podium up to Dr. Georges Benjamin, who's going to talk about how Action Area 1, Making Health a Shared Value, resonates with the work of the American Public Health Association.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. What do I need to do? Did I push them? Push one more to get your slide. There we go. A couple years ago, APHA board sat down and we talked about what we thought our strategic direction ought to be. And we were perplexed, of course, as to why our nation was not amongst the healthiest nations. And we set out as a strategic goal that we felt that we should work very hard to make sure that our nation was in the number one spot, that we were would become the healthiest nation. And we decided that we needed to have a stretch goal, and that stretch goal ought to be 2030, basically representing one generation. It is indeed an ambitious goal. It's a stretch goal. There are lots of folks that say, well, you can't do that. We don't agree with that at all. We think that there are many ways in which to achieve these goals. But I think you heard Dr. Plow talk about how you do that. It's with focus, it's with collaborations, and it's cross sectors. So we've thought a lot about how to make that happen. If you think about the fact that there are just lots of groups out there that have kind of come to this same understanding. So you've got Bob Ross and the California Endowment with their Health Happens Here work. And they've been transformative in California in getting people to think more globally about health across many sectors. And if they can do that in a large state as California, we certainly can scale that up across the nation. But it does require coordination across all of our groups. You got the Somali Institute, which is looking at wellness as a core value and looking at even through the lens of alternative and complementary medicine. You've got the 100 Million Healthier Lives campaign from the Institute of Healthcare Improvement, who's looking at this. And they're basically looking at how to make health systems think more broadly and to bring the social determinants health of health through a different lens. So you have lots of groups that are kind of doing this. And the goal here from the APHA perspective is try to get all these organizations marching in the same direction, coordinating their activities, leveraging what each of us do, and making this kind of a normative behavior, a shared expectation of our nation as we go forward. And this holistic approach to doing so means, of course, bringing all sectors. And I don't know, you can emphasize this more and more. As you see this meeting, which is about health and our policies, we're trying to emphasize that as much as we can to try to get all of the various sectors involved in this so that they at least think of at least a piece of what they do as healthy options for their various discipline. And to doing that, of course, we've created something what we call as Generation Public Health. We formally kicked it off officially this year at the annual meeting. And one of the reasons we felt this so strongly is that if you actually go back and look at the Institute of Medicine report that was released almost a year ago now, Steve Wolf and his colleagues looked at why our nation was not the healthiest. And they made several recommendations. And one of the recommendations they made was that we needed to do a much better job of educating the public about where we stand on health, to celebrate as much as we can the fact that we can fix things better than any place else in the world. You break it, we fix it. You crash your ports, we can put you back better than you were before. If you get cancer now, we've made enormous improvements in cancer. But we all know that prevention and preventing these things from happening in the first place is a far more wiser course. And that really, even then, that we have to go beyond that and talk about wellness and health in a much more broader sphere. So they talked about building basically a movement. They recommended, one of the IOM recommendations was a movement. And we said, yeah, that's what APHA ought to do. We ought to be involved in that movement and moving that movement along. So to tell you some of the things that we're doing programmatically to make that happen is that we partnered with the American Planning Association in a variety of areas, looking at the built environment. Our affiliates at every state are thinking about this more effectively, and we've gotten some grant funds to partner between APHA's affiliates and American Planning Association affiliates to begin thinking about how they can advocate for better planning at the local level. Bringing planners into the public health community as public health folks. We shared sessions at each other's meetings, began to try to better educate the members of our disciplines around each other's fields. We've worked with a lot of folks on climate change. We see climate change as kind of one of these overarching problems. And we joined a coalition called Eco America, in which we are one of the health leads of the Equal America Coalition. But this is a fascinating coalition because it includes not only the business community and the public health community, but it includes the faith community and the education community. And we are all trying to change the conversation, again, that climate change is real. People have a very much component in it, but more importantly, that it's not too big a problem that we can do something about it and that it will ultimately affect our health, and there are things we need to do to be involved. And so we've done those kinds of programs. Again, that's a movement. And we have also done some things around some concrete things. We work with the Department of Transportation, for example. We just launched, just at this meeting, a transportation and health tool to help people, help planners think about and transportation people think about health as part of their transportation decisions. To help people map out communities, and it's a very fascinating tool, and I commend you to go on our website and look that tool up as well and to utilize that. And then finally, we have been doing a lot around media advocacy. Media advocacy, of course, is I think is one of our strong suits, and We do a lot. We have over 700,000 people in our social media systems, unique users. And we try to engage them because we want to have this conversation around health each and every day. So everything that we do, the annual meeting, National Public Health Week, when we have a webinar, we're now engaging people far beyond our core membership to be part of this. And when you become part of that, we then make you a member of Generation Public Health. Because what we want to do is have a unifying concept and theme so that all these folks are part of a grassroots movement that talks about health, that builds tools around health, that partners with people outside of their normal comfort zones to move health in a wonderful place. And of course, that brings us to our partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which clearly has set the real broad framework for this. And we are going to continue to work with IWJ on this because we think this really is the way to make people healthier and to really make this something that's shared, this normative behavior to do things that that are healthy from in our society. Thank you.
Thank you, Douglas. We're going to move on to action area two, and we'll welcome our next speaker. Kevin, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. How are you today? Glad to hear that. Since I'm not the only doctor in the room here, I just wanted to let you know I don't have a DR in front of my name, but behind my name, so to speak. I want to talk a little bit about the YMCA and what we've been doing in terms of course collaboration and engaging in this health work. First of all, a little bit about the why. 1844 in London, England. And the Y was an organization that was responding to the transformation of us moving from an agrarian society to a metropolitan society. And George Williams, who discovered us, George Williams was 24 years old. Came to Boston in 1851, which I happened to work in my last job. And so we've been around just about 170 years, doing a lot of work that I'm sure as some of you may or may not know. If I ask the question, how many of you learned to swim at the Y? How many hands would go up? See? And how many of you went to camp at a YMCA? Always, always. I had a board member who always said the Y was one of the few American experiences that everybody can relate to, regardless of where you are. So with this work that we're doing is part of that process. More information. 80% of U.S. households are located within a 5-mile radius of a YMCA. And why is it important for us to continue this work? We have 22 million members, 870 associations, and we're in 2,700 physical buildings. Now, I know that there's probably about 3,000 or so county, health county organizations. So we're just about the same number that they have in this, across this country. So we have what I would say is a basis of work by which we can work collectively together to really change the way health is delivered in this country and how we can help resolve some of that. We see being on the preventative side, as many as our panelists said earlier, is the way to approach this method. And that's the way we're looking at it. One of the things I say, I believe that a social problem can be solved by one organization alone that is not big enough problem to be concentrating our efforts on. And for this one we have in front of us, we need a lot of folks engaged in this process. And from my perspective, I want the Y to concentrate on the big, challenging problems that can only be addressed through multi-sector, multi-stakeholder collaboration. So I know I'm speaking to the choir here today, but those are the perspectives that I've had as the CEO of the YMCA of the USA. So in a few minutes, I'll talk about two such efforts that I think will illustrate the power of collaboration in leading to document health-related outcomes. Without collaborations, these events would not be possible. Okay. The first one is really about closing the achievement gap, which is a big issue for us in this country, as we well know. We've been working with an organization called BEL, Building Educated Leaders for Life. Power Scholars is a six-week summer program designed to tackle summer learning in math and reading and foster physical and social emotional growth for our young folks. As you can see in the circles, the concentric circles, we're not doing this alone. YUSA, local YMCA, schools, Bell, and the community are all involved in this effort. And I know you're looking at the numbers because that's what most of us go to right away, right? So far, we just started this about a year. We have 1,190 children in 10 sites in 2014. And you can see the results, evaluated by a third party, average 2.5 months in reading and 2.5 months in math. When we know that these young individual young folks traditionally lose 3 to 4 months. So this is a significant gain. And look at the parent support, very important in this process. And I will tell you, this is the average. We've had places where this work has been done, where it's been 4 months in math, 5 months in reading, but this is the average that we've been getting. Very important aspect of what we're trying to do to ensure that these young folks do what they need to do to maximize their potential. Why is that important? Well, it does have direct relationship to health outcomes too. That's why it's important that they have this work being done in our communities. And I would also say, and I didn't bring that slide before I go to the next slide, we've been working with the Secretary of Interior to do what we call play, learn, serve, and work to get those individuals out to the park. We kicked this off in 25 cities, not by ourselves, with the National League of Cities, the mayors, the National Park Service, all of those individuals, to ensure that kids were outside, getting engaged in exercise, having an opportunity to understand the great resources that we have in our national park system. Just another example of how we're engaging those individuals in those communities from a total health perspective. Now this next program that we've been engaged with for a while, this is about reducing chronic disease together. I have two of my great partners in the room with me. Jonathan Lever, who's our Vice President for Healthy Living, and the guy who's really doing all the work, Dr. Matt Longer. We do have a doctor, a medical doctor on our team, and he's been exceptional in helping us move this process forward. We all know about the diabetes issues that are going on in this country, what that leads to from a chronic disease perspective. Behavior change program that helps adults at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes reduce their risk for developing the disease by taking steps that will improve their overall health and well-being. You can see, we're not even doing this at WISE in general. We're doing it in the communities, at churches, at libraries, with community development organizations. Physicians are involved in this, payers and insurers, health departments, local WISE, and YUSA. That's the circles that you see that is helping this happen. And let's talk about what the numbers say. I knew you already read them, but I have to do it anyway. 37,000 individuals engaged in this process. Look at the locations, 1,371 locations in 43 states. Average weight loss, 5.5%, and more than 58% reduction in new cases of type 2 diabetes. This is the kind of work we're engaging with so many others, because we believe that this kind of work can significantly reduce health costs in this country. And our partners, we have several, American Diabetes Association, American Heart Association, AMA, NCA, National Cancer of La Raza, the YMCA, so many people that are involved in this to ensure that we're doing the things that we need to do to reach the people that we need to do. We know 86 million people are pre-diabetic, and we're just reaching a handful of those. We're looking at how do we continue to do this work in a much more explosive way, and we're looking at strategies within our national organization to continue to expand the number of people engaged in this work. So opportunity, I know there's a lot of folks from the counties in here. If you didn't know about it, reach out to your local YMCA. We're ready to work with each and every one of you who are going to address this issue. And finally, I know we're doing some work in blood pressure management, just started this with the CDC and a couple of pilot programs in the South, and we've seen remarkable results, particularly with African-American men. So I say to you, we're really pleased to be working with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation as part of this work. We're looking at a couple of strategies around clinic to community, one strategy, and the other one is around creating best outcomes in the relationship for young children, so that we can not only do it for, of course, the why, I got to do a little bit for the why, but more importantly, for the field in early child development. Thank you for having me today. Hopefully you have an opportunity to reach out to your local Y and let them know that we do a little bit more than gym and swim. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Karen is going to tell us how some of the themes that that pediatrics of the American Association of Pediatricians, how they're resonating with Action Area 3.
So I did learn how to swim at the Y. So the good news is I moved to an ocean, and it was a good thing to have had that experience. So I'm going to one-up Dr. Washington. How many of you raise your hand high if you know a pediatrician that you like and care about? Okay, now how many of you love a child? I could leave that hand up, put them together. That's why we're here today, okay? And so because people would wonder why the Academy from other different medical societies or what do we do, and really because, as you can see from the first slide, the foundation of a successful society is truly built in early childhood. So we know how important, and I want you to notice this is from Harvard, not from us, but healthy child development does what? Educational achievement, economic productivity, responsible citizenship, lifelong health, strong communities, a healthy economy, and successful parenting of the next generation. So does that kind of sound like what we're all here wanting, right? And I think the important thing is, as we talk about this, we're learning not just through opinion, but at the Academy, we're very driven by science, that we really are looking at the evidence of how do we make sure that happens. And so here is a project, and I love the little jumping guy, that we are with, if you can see at the bottom, the Department of Justice. Why the Department of Justice? We're learning about adverse childhood experiences, and many of you in the room know about the report that came out talking about that. Many of you intuitively could have said 30 years ago when I started practicing, I knew that in my head. We know that children that have are exposed to emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, that have emotional or physical neglect, if their mother was treated violently by a partner, if there's household substance abuse or mental illness or parental separation or divorce, or someone in the family is incarcerated. Those are all considered adverse childhood events. All of those make you much more likely to be not just unhappy and sick as a child, but to have significant health problems as an adult. So unlikely partners with the Department of Justice, but they want to help us make sure that children don't have adverse childhood events so they won't enter the justice system. So why do early experiences matter? Whenever I look at this, I go, wow. So newborn brain to a brain at 2 years of age, who can do the math? How many times did it grow? 3 times. Think about 3 times, how fast that happens. And think about when your baby first comes home and all they do is cry and you think you're a horrible mother or father because you can't get them to stop. And then how quickly they learn everything. They're sponges. They just soak up everything we learn. And this is what's most important to me, is if you look at the dramatic growth of neuronal architecture from birth to 2 years. So that's what a newborn brain looks like. And the way to think of these is we have neurons, which are like the houses that contain information, and we have synapses, which are the little highways and roads that connect them up. We want our children to have the most they can possibly have, because they will have the most opportunity to be able to be successful in society. Adverse childhood events, we know now by science, impacts how those neurons and synapses grow. So the good news here is everything's not done at birth. The bad news here is what happens in early childhood has a significant impact on children. So what we want to make sure we do is really maximize in their early childhood years being exposed to a positive environment, positive nutrition, and lots of love. So 700 new synapses, okay? So think about that. How many are being created every second in those first years? And of course, we had to come up with an analogy, and I have to speak to my friend Van Tate, the pediatric neurologist who's here with me and does a lot of this work. Families are the center. They're the house that's in the middle. We are all the other little homes that connect up through highways. We need to make sure that those highways all go straight to the family. The family is in the center. So it's great that we're here today, but most importantly, and I challenge all of us to think next time, we need a family talking with us too, because we all are there, whether it's through all the various programs we've talked about, to support the family. And I think if we keep that idea central, we'll be successful. So how does income affect health? I think everybody here will talk to pieces and parts of this. Food insecurity, lack of health insurance, poor housing and homelessness, safety and violence, immigration status is huge, and other discrimination in education all lead to poor health. Why I show you this is I want to also share with you another project that we're involved in, and this is particularly exciting to us. This is called Face Poverty. Looks at food insecurity, access to health care, community and education. But what's most important about this project is it's our residents in pediatrics that started it. Our residents in pediatrics, our pediatricians in training, said we no longer are comfortable just taking care of ear infections and colds. We know when people come to see us, whether it be in the emergency department or in a clinic, or when I'm taking care of them on the floor with asthma, that they are facing adverse childhood experiences and we need to be armed with ways to help. So what's exciting to me is this is a grassroots effort by residents across the country. They are using tools and technology and approaches that we would never have dreamt of. Even with all of our grants and smart people at the top, we've got people here thinking and moving. We do a lot of work with our residents with legal aid. So an interesting, a lot of people who are going through adverse childhood experiences and families that are going through that have great difficulty with access to good legal help, whether it be to make sure that my apartment is up to code and whether the person that I'm renting for follows the rules of that city, to many other different aspects. So it's really exciting to see the residents making a difference. And lastly, I'll leave you with another example. We have a chapter in California who realizes the local area, realized that there are children that were coming in who were increasingly answering a screening question that, have you or your children not had enough food any time in the last month? And they were answering yes more and more. So that chapter put together a local food drive, worked with the food bank to make sure that specifically families with young children had access not just to food, but to healthy food for the children. And then rather than having to take their small children and go to the food bank, the food was brought to the practice in the clinic and to be able to be shared with all of them. I think it's important on two levels. It not only helped those families, but much more importantly, it helped those pediatricians to better understand the environment and world in which their families are living so that they can put them in the center again. And I think that's a real important thing, my message that I'd end with, is to make sure we always put the family in the center. If we do, I think we can be successful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And lastly, on action area four, strengthening integration of health services systems. And Kenneth, you've been very, very patient. So thank you for presenting what your organization is doing in this area.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, and good afternoon. I don't think I have anything left to say. So with that, we bring the session to a close. I have had the privilege of being a transplant physician and had an opportunity to see a number of miracles happen within the walls of hospitals and health systems across the United States. But as I was doing that, I kept going back to something that was burning in the back of my head that my grandmother kept reminding me of. And that was that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. And U.S. healthcare and hospitals and health systems are absolutely wonderful about delivering a pound of cure. But it is something that, as you saw, the data that were presented early on, we cannot afford to continue that isolated path any longer. And the American Hospital Association is dramatically trying to push the envelope to get hospitals and health systems to engage deeply with their community members to build networks that are focused further and further upstream to make certain that we get back to my grandmother's vision of preventing rather than treating. So one of the things I'd like to show you a bit today is just some of what we're doing here at the American Hospital Association, particularly through the division that I'm a part of, which is the Health Research and Educational Trust, which is really designed around research and education of key issues. We had an opportunity a couple of years ago to work with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and published a guide in October 2014, which I'll show you at the very end of this that you can get access to if you've not yet seen, that allowed us to categorize what hospitals and health systems are doing in the country. We took the community health needs assessments, over 2,000 of these, and began to catalog the activities that were ongoing within the communities. And we did a sub-analysis of 300 specific CHNAs, and we found that there were key things that were sticking out that were being very evident that communities were engaged in. First, from a health system point of view, it was very important that the health system had to better understand what it was and what they were doing in the community. So they looked deeply at themselves, the missions and so forth. And then they had to turn to the community and find out what the availability was of people who were committed to doing something in a positive way to help health in the community. And then they had to find the catalog of people who were shareholders and partners who could, in fact, all come together in one table. Now, we do know that communities are very different. And one of the things we learned in reviewing and in analyzing this subsegment of the CHNAs is that there were some categories that seemed to step forward. We all would love to work with anchor communities, in which case the hospital and health system is very deeply involved, both from a resource perspective, from a mission and a strategic planning perspective, and quote unquote puts its money where its mouth is so that everybody is on the same page in that community. But quite frankly, that's just not all American communities. So we had to really appreciate the fact that we have to meet American communities where they lie. And in fact, we have some that are healthcare communities sponsored by hospitals and health systems that are specialists. These are hospitals and health systems that have a narrow approach of what they can provide. So they might dramatically get involved with the community with respect to chronic disease management around one individual disease. Doesn't mean that they're not valued or important, but it means that's where they are on the path at the present time. There were some who are promoters. These are the ones that are the greatest cheerleaders in their community. They advocate strongly. They try to help provide resources in terms of dollars and staff to try to help promote the delivery of a healthier set of communities and ideas going forward. Finally, we have the conveners, and these are the people who do a wonderful job of collaborating in a broad fashion with any number of community organizations all focusing on health. They may not themselves have the wherewithal to be able to design and deploy significant interventions across from a scope perspective, but they are in fact very capable of promoting community health by convening and looking at agendas that are found within communities. Now, one of the things that we did do is we took an opportune time to evaluate some best practices, and one of those I just wanted to share with you. And it is Spartanburg Regional Healthcare in North Central South Carolina. This is an organization that is an integrated delivery system. They have a large tertiary hospital. They have an acute care hospital that is of and about the community. And they have a long-term acute care facility. Now, one of the things that they found in looking at their own individual strategies was that they could do things better. And as they looked in their own population that they were assisting and providing care for in their community, they reached out to 10 community organizations and had a blue ribbon panel come together and say, what could we do if we all functioned better together, if we could integrate our activities and consolidate rather than be at odds with one another? Well, they evaluated a population of patients, it was about 1,500 patients, who had really poor access to primary and specialty medical care. These, in fact, were responsible, these uninsured patients were responsible for generating about $116 million in uncompensated care each year. This is a big problem for a community like Spartanburg. And in the course of a year, this organization, pulling together with its 10 community partners, designed an access system that promoted better primary and specialty care access for those citizens. And what did they find? They found the things that my grandmother would have predicted that they would find. They found shorter hospital lengths of stay. They found a 31% reduction in admission rates, and they reduced the cost of care in that community by $35 million per year. That's not peanuts. And imagine if there is one Spartanburg out there. There are 4,000 Spartanburgs that are out there just waiting to come forward. So we are really pushing these best practice examples. And in fact, the guide, if you refer to that, has 10 such examples that take on the roles from convener to promoter to anchor. And if you will turn to that, you will see hope that we have now that American hospitals are coming forward to try to help and be a part of the solution. So the question comes, what has the AHA done and what are they doing right now? Well, this isn't your grandfather's American Hospital Association any longer. We understand that we have to be by and about and for our communities. We have to develop strong personal partnerships within our communities, and we are encouraging our hospital members to do the same. We have a number of educational resources that are available for all of our member institutions to refer to. One of them I'll show you in just a second, and that is available on the hpoe.org website for any of you who would like to see. These reflect a number of partnerships we have, and we're very proud to have been in partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in putting together Building a Culture of Health publication. The second is we're challenging each of our organizations to sign up and commit to a pledge of the 1-2-3-4 Equity campaign. What this is designed to do is it's designed to stimulate and challenge our members to really think more broadly than just race, ethnicity, and language data, but to design programs that are broadly applicable to a variety of community subpopulations. We've put together a population health task force, and any number of divisions within AHA are looking at ways of improving the population's health rather than approaching it from a disease approach. And we're putting all of those into one quarterly report generated by the American Hospital Association. And you'll find some of those coming forward in January of 2016. Identification of exemplar organizations. As I mentioned, we have 10 of them found in the particular guide we have. We're in the process right now of re-examining all of the community health needs assessments that are found submitted across the country. We'll do the same type of analysis working with RWJF. And we're very excited to show you how U.S. healthcare is changing over time. And we did, as a part of that initial publication, promote a 10-step approach to developing a culture of creating health for communities. And then finally, nothing works better than if one lives the vision personally. So the American Hospital Association is providing direct and active support. I was just in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago for the Root Cause Coalition, and that was a group of organizations coming together to try to reduce food insecurity and poverty and hunger in the United States. So we are strong advocates, but we are also leading with our strength, which is the direct influence of U.S. healthcare systems. So with that, this is the copy of the guide that was published in October 2014. Please feel free to access it. It's free on the website, and it's full of tremendous amounts of information on how you might improve the health of your communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. Excellent. We'll start to get your questions together because we really want to have a dialogue with myself and any member of the panel. But before we get to that, I did want to end with this in our outcome slide, that if all the innovative work that you've heard from our partners and all the aspirations for innovation you saw in our model, if that comes to pass, if that level of collaboration comes to pass, we think we could move some pretty large long-term indicators over this course of time, and those are those long-term measures. And just to kind of kick off the panel part of discussion, since you mentioned the work that the American Academy of Pediatrics is doing around adverse child events, that's one of our long-term outcome measures. We'd like to improve that situation. Tell us what kinds of things you're doing, how do you see the challenge, and what kind of progress, Karen, do you think we're making around this particular long-term objective?
Well, and it's a huge long-term objective, because you can imagine adverse childhood events are really everything that impacts a child in life. So we are looking at a national level. One of the things that we were able to do, which I think speaks to exactly what we've been talking about here, is we'll become the Head Start grant. The Head Start, if you all know what Head Start is for early childhood education, is now including health. so it's huge. We just got the grant for it. I say it's huge because if we can impact and make sure that people who are engaged in Head Start, the people who care for those children, the people who nurture those children, the people who work there, the parents who bring their children there, understand how important health is in those first few years, we can really make a difference. And that's going to allow us to be able to get some of the most important messages, not just about adverse childhood events, because many of the things on those lists, the child's already in that environment. But what we also need to teach is how do you become resilient? How do you not just have increasing levels of toxic stress so that someday you see an adult physician and they say, oh, check, this is why you've got diabetes or this is why you have heart disease. Our goal is to say, how do we help work with parents and early caregivers from visiting, anybody who surrounds those children to say, how do we make them more resilient in that situation? So how do we teach parents good parenting in a way that makes sense to them? How do we really try and work with that family? You'll hear me say family a lot. Whatever family looks like, to surround that children with the best environment they can have. And so I think that's one example of things we're doing.
Great example. Any other member of the panel want to respond to either her comments or the other presentations?
Let me just add that all of what we want to do is around population health needs to be data driven. And people need to know the numbers. And there are many ways to do so. You know, this nation puts out lots of reports in a variety of venues. I'll commend you to two of them. One, certainly the state health rankings that we do with United Healthcare Foundation, which looks at how states rank. And we've had states that have taken that seriously and have looked at the things that they do well and looked at the things they have not done well, have been able to change their numbers. They've had to focus on those areas, but they've done well. The second one, of course, is the county health rankings, which I think is very important because it shows a couple things. Number one, again, what the health is of that individual community, so it's helpful to deal with things where things really change is at the very most local level. But it also paints a picture very much like the map that Alonzo showed us earlier, which shows County A next to County B with enormous disparities in their health. And you know, imagine having counties and cities competing to be more healthy. Mayors and county commissioners saying, you know, just like they do for all the sports games, you know, I bet you X we can improve the health of our community by Y. And so we need to gin up this experience using data, and basically try to use that as a tool to march our way towards population health, community by community.
Kenneth.
And I just want to give one more pitch for the internal data as well. There are all kinds of data that are collected and reported about how communities look and their state of health. Within every electronic medical record resides a tremendous amount of useful information. I came from an organization that began to use that information to develop an algorithm to try to find people who had not only unrecognized hypertension, who needed some immediate help, but they were also recognizing the pre-hypertensive patients, the patients who were just on the liftoff to becoming unhealthy. So it's external information, and it's also the internal information that's quite powerful in the electronic health record.
Okay, I can open it up to questions from the audience, and again thank the panel for some very invigorating presentations. Hands, do we have mics, or are we going to have to do this without mics? Looks like we don't have mics. So just stand, identify yourself, and...
Bert Lightshow from Mobile, Alabama. One of the issues I commend everybody on the panel, but we know that poverty and poor health seem to correlate. Is anybody looking at the issue of predatory lending as it goes in the United States? In the great state of Alabama, you can borrow money legally and pay 400% interest. That does not make for a healthy community.
Karen.
I can tell you, you know, the American Pediatrics is 64,000 pediatricians, and so I just represent, you know, kind of the garden variety pediatrician representing all of them. And this is an issue that every year we talk about, where should the academy go? Many, community members and continue to say it's not what we normally think of as a pediatrician's role, but that their families are really struggling with how they make this decision to borrow to pay for, you know, for food for this week, and then they're, it's a vicious cycle. So I think we have a lot of our chapters on state levels and on local levels to have laws in place to stop predatory lending. And unfortunately, the same people who are not educated about what interest rates really are and what this really means, and they get caught in a vicious circle. So I know I can speak for our members, it's a very important issue, especially for young families.
I can just say for the foundation and our set of measures, poverty and the impact of poverty and marginalization cuts across a number of measures. We get a chance to look at it, measures such as residential segregation or housing affordability. We try to capitalize on a couple of measures that lift up those situations that need to be overcome by those populations. So I'll just go who I saw first, and again, to let us know who you are and a brief question.
Western North Carolina in Buncombe County. We were one of your Robert Johnson Cultural Health Prize winners. We have a great...
Congratulations. great effort.
We work with our local YMCA, a lot of local public health, community public health, and I started an AIDS collaborative in our community, so we have a lot of stuff going on. I have a very simple question, and that is with number one, making health a shared value. We talked a little and worked in our community with the Frameworks Institute around early childhood toxic stress. And one of the things I learned from them, which shocked me, was that they found Americans do not value health. That is not a value of American people. And I'm wondering how you came to this and what kind of framing you see happening in order to make Americans value health.
That is a great question, and I want to recognize my colleagues from the RAND Corporation who are not nodding as you talked. The Action Area 1, we think, is one of the most important drivers of everything, but it's the area we know the least about. Well, we do know that Americans, by default, don't value health in a well-being sense, and that differentiates us from other parts of the world. Our neighbors to the north in Canada have a well-being index. I just got back from the UK. They speak about well-being a lot. That's not a term we use often here. So what we're doing with Action Area 1, a number of things. We have a national survey that we've done that will be the first analysis of how the American people are thinking about health in a culture of health way that we'll be releasing soon. It'll be on this new website, cultureofhealth.org, so we can get a baseline, because I think we want to improve from where we know we are, because we think about more around the absence of illness rather than well-being. We've also developed a number of different kind of research programs that we're funding, as well as other kinds of programmatic interventions to understand how communities do collective impact, work together, and build a value of health in their activities. And you'll be able to see a lot of those stories and the data on the new cultureofhealth.org website. Yes, Anthony.
The question is, what else besides race, ethnicity, and language data? And these are exactly the kinds of elements that we're beginning to encourage our members to start collecting. The reason that that's so important to us is that this is, in some ways, mastered in some, the real data is mastered in some organizations. It's in the process of being mastered in others, and in fact, it's still somewhat shiny in others. So we're trying to still promote that agenda. We've got to get that at its base. But we're also encouraging people in this Looking Free for Equity campaign, collect information about the things that are important to you in your community. Maybe it's veteran populations that are having a difficult time getting access to care or who are in poverty. It may be zip code-based data related to economic trends. These are the kinds of information we can pull together and look at from a big data point of view that will help that individual community to identify what's most relevant to them and to push forward from there.
Yes.
Thank you for the invitation. My name is Dr. Peter Ryan. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Texas. how the Minister of Education has to teach from country of health, because what has been spoken about is poverty and education, as you can see, and it appears like in the current event that we're seeing, especially for mass shooting, we have not really established whether it's the family, that is at fault, or whether it's the community, because we talk about stigma and lack of access to facilities, but the family was not conscious of the stigma. So where are we in terms of the culture of health in relation to mental health, and how we can work forward? Do we allow our families or communities, and how do we do that?
I'm going to repeat just a bit of your good question so everybody can hear this. And the central question is, where is mental health in the culture of health? How are we going to deal with the problem of stigma in mental health? How are we going to deal with the other attendant issues that relate to mental health that sometimes pop up as violence? And how are we doing dealing with this programmatically? Do any of the partners here want to start, Karen?
I'll be happy to start, since we start with babies and children. Part of that is making sure that pediatricians feel increasingly more empowered to take care of children with mental health problems, to identify and get help. Frequently, you're the trusted health caregiver in a family. So if you identify a parent who has issues, we're focusing on how to do maternal depression screening so we can help women. So really enabling our pediatricians to get the training that they need to be able to identify and care for simple mental health problems. But it's also then a good referral source, and more importantly, to screen early on. And as the same thing, if we talk about adverse childhood events, you're much more likely to have problems with mental health issues as a young adult or adult if you've suffered adverse childhood events and don't have a culture of resiliency built around you. So we're in the process of, and I can't say we've fixed it completely, because we are really working with a generational change where pediatricians traditionally, 30 years ago when I started, you saw very little mental health problems in children or in families, and if you did, someone else took care of them. Now, you can talk, most pediatric emergency departments, what fills up their beds are mental health cases that need acute care, not, you know, we've gone from, because of vaccines, we've gone from infectious diseases to mental health diseases as being what's there. So we really are working closely through education of our providers, but also really strengthening that idea of identifying adverse childhood events and acting early.
Any other comments from the panel? Yes.
Just one other position point from the American Hospital Association. We are advocating a comprehensive view of health. And one of the stories we're trying to tell is, why are we having readmissions? Why are we having medication discontinuation? Why are we having adherence difficulties with medical strategies? In part, it's because there are other things that are going on. It may be that an individual has to make a decision, do I pay my rent or do I take my medication? It may be that people don't have the logical wherewithal to understand the health strategy, a health literacy issue. It may be because there are mental and behavioral health issues. So we're advocating for a comprehensive view. That the only way it'll ever make sense is if we take a comprehensive view of the patient.
And then just from the point of the culture of health framework, I mean, we use the term well-being so much because it implies both mental well-being as well as beyond just physical health. We have a particular measure that we're tracking on access to mental health services and themes of resilience and social and emotional development in young children, I think, speak to the way that we're trying to address mental health issues within the framework. I'll go to the middle back. Yes.
Love the framework, appreciate and trust the group that is here, the panel there, but I've heard it a little bit, but I'm not hearing faith in the framework. For very tough issues that we all know and work with, such as social justice issues around racism, a culture of inclusion, we're right now working in a very tough political environment of where hate is there, and I know this is a data-driven process, you can say, you know, all of us in this room know. Where in this robust framework is there space for the grantees or folks that are working in it to have this dialogue around these things that we know are barriers to achieving these outcomes?
Yeah. George's.
Yeah, so APHA has begun doing a fair amount of work in the justice and health area. We had a series of webinars on racism and health. I was pleased to do a webinar for a video for the California Endowment, primarily focused to California for their purposes, on the school-to-prison pipeline. And our incoming president is very much interested in racism and health, and will be spending her presidential year ginning up this as an issue, again, raising awareness, linking the whole issue of racism to health. He has an amazing tale that she tells, which talks about issues of privilege, bias, and the way we approach our lives in many ways in an unconscious way. It is difficult, and we have people out there that have, excuse the pun, the mental health one, but absolutely lost their minds. And we're having to deal with it in a very, very tough political environment where racism, discrimination, and hate is being tolerated in ways that make absolutely no sense. Frankly, if I was the sound guy at most of these debates, I would simply cut the sound off. Because I think that the media is perpetuating this by simply under the guise of covering it. We do not have to listen to that nonsense. Now, of course, you all control that too. All you gotta do is put the button and cut the clicker off, and you don't have to listen to it either, and don't let your kids listen to it, and then their ratings go down, their money goes down, people stop doing that nonsense.
Hey, but let me just quick. Oh, George, you have more?
No, I'm just. Okay. But I do think it is something that we need to, in a very strategic way, think about how we approach this, realizing that the minute you talk about racism, in particular, people turn the lights off and turn away from it, and we've got to find ways to articulate that, in ways to talk about people where they are, because we all have biases, but we often don't want to accept them.
April, I'm just from the foundation's perspective, when you have a chance to get on our new website and see the report, you'll see that achieving health equity cuts across all of what we do. And in order to do that, we have to deal with the issues that you raised up. Even in the 41 measures, we tried to pick a few things that really pointed to the impact of racism on poor health outcomes: residential segregation, housing affordability, does your community have an adequate level of community policing training? So we, you know, in 41 measures, you can only incorporate a few of those, but those are to bring up those kinds of impacts of marginalization that don't lead to equal health outcomes. Yes, you had your hand up a couple times.
Actually, perfect segue to your question, your answer. My name is Angela Thrasher from UNC Chapel Hill. And I remember during the RWJ, Commission of Global Health in America, one of the side benefits was a nice set of lessons learned about how to communicate about social determinants of health. And what have you all, during this current process, both the individual partners and RWJ as a foundation, learned about creating these metrics that deal with all these disparate issues, especially the ones that address the very difficult issues that we all face, but that can cross, go across areas, but also show outcomes and progress. That would be helpful.
Yes. Cool. You guys think? I'll try to think.
Okay. We build. I mean, certainly build their work into our messaging as much as we can.
Yeah. I'm going to take up just a part of your question, because the whole point of building a movement is try to connect with as many people as you can. And to have pretty a wide tent. I mean, and George, you mentioned it in the opening session, that we have to reach out and figure out how to connect with people that we haven't connected before, that we might think of as the other and not really aligned with us. I can tell you that what we've done with this framework, which is an equity and social justice framework, but we have had conversations with folks on the part of the political continuum that we never had conversations before, to find some common ground, find some language that they could see themselves in to work on health equity issues with us. So I think from the commission report, the work that we did in vetting this with some of the big conservative foundations in D.C., you would know the names. We found that as much as possible, not making language a barrier if we can find common ground around what you need to do with equity, and you'll see some of that in the report when you get a chance to look at it. Yes.
Nancy Kaufman, and I get out and talk to some interesting folks, like rural county boards and supervisors and things like that, that are responsible for the health budget. I'm glad language came up because I've been running across some real language barriers up there. One of them is around social determinants and the word social. And so I asked the children to call them these full-fledged grown-up determinants of health, because they are. They determine our health. And so I hope we can get to a point where we don't have to like label something. So a certain segment of the population doesn't feel they belong to making change happen.
Good points. Yes. Yes.
We had a wonderful experience building partnerships across many sectors at the universities. The three were there now to help the helping kids, helping communities, and establishing an institute called FEALS, Health Leading Action. And the important thing is that more and more different organizations are joining it in different ways. Things change, right? You know, they the same and it's different. But what I wanted to bring forward now, because of the discussion of how important adverse experiences in early childhood are, there are many children, Hispanic children in the United States, who have been left abandoned because their parents were deported. And some of them are living with extended family, taxing already very poor conditions, and some of them are with faith-based organizations. And I wonder how we can reach out, because of all this hate and all this very critical political situation against immigrants, how this could also be embraced.
Did you, everyone hear the question, the impact of deportation on the immigrant community, children who have been separated from their families, who have been deported, in the context, when you think about adverse child events, that is a clear adverse child event. Dr. Emily, do you want to comment on that?
I would just say again, through our pediatricians, through especially our pediatricians in Texas, brought this quickly to our attention. We have a policy statement, and we firmly believe as pediatricians that children should not be kept in detention centers, that they should be with family, and if not with family, for people who can give them the closest type of family situation as they can possibly be. And we advocate at the federal level with both ICE and with the Department of Justice to make sure that children, because we talked about we don't value health in our country, we don't value children the way we do adults in our country too, that these children don't fall through the cracks. Our incoming president has actually visited detention centers, and we really are, I think, it's been very good for me to see that 64,000 pediatricians have embraced this issue, some who will never see these kids, because we all realize how incredibly important it is for exactly what you said. So if you need policy statements or anywhere you want to have more information about it, come to our website because it's right there.
Great. Thank you.
The
children
have been deported.
The parents, well, no. Parents get deported. The kids
are left behind. Yeah, the kids are abandoned. Yes,
right.
And that's extraordinary.
And that is what we're talking about. Right. The kids are left behind.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Yes, in the back. And please try to speak up because you're in a distant place. Yes.
I think one's really important, one's hard, because our pediatricians say you keep giving me more questions to ask and things to look at and you're not taking anything away and I have 15 minutes with this family. So we're working with our pediatricians to help understand how to do that. Probably most of you know about Bright Futures, which is a framework that pediatricians use for young children. This is worked into that, so they'll have an opportunity to figure out how to have that question. The more important thing for pediatricians that you can help us with is now that I ask the question, what do I do with the answer? So when a family says to me, yes, There are multiple times in the last month we went to bed hungry. How do we have that pediatrician know what resources are available? So we're working with chapters, those are our state level organizations, to try and get them to understand, how do I understand what exists in my community and connect people up with those resources? Because if I'm a pediatrician with hair my color, I might be used to working and taking care of people in my office, but I don't really understand what else is out there that might help them. So we're really working on how do we educate those pediatricians to learn, to work with community partners, to make sure they understand what that means and how we connect them up. So I think it's really an important issue.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, I think there has been a trend in the funders world to foster collaboration. And from my perspective, having been in this work for 37 and a half years, it needs to develop organically. Our success with Bell is because we went out looking for someone who did it best, and they were clearly identified as such. So it made a natural opportunity for us to merge. And the other things that we're doing with the National Diabetes Association, it really makes more sense if you allow it to happen organically. We've seen too many opportunities. First of all, collaboration in and of itself is a very difficult process. You've got three or four different organizations working with different perspectives, different boards, different staffs, all of those kinds of issues. But when you force it to happen, it usually doesn't sustain itself. So I would say to you, while I understand your need to have a collaborative relationship with those individuals from a broader perspective, they can serve more people, get more done, one plus one does equal three. Some instances, of course, that just from my perspective, what my experience tells me, that it's more better to develop organically than to force it from the one perspective.
Okay, thanks. And well, of course, in follow-up to that, so another thing we do is also introduce people that we know that may not know each other. Is that something that's more of you in your opinion or better?
Yes, I mean, I think that's certainly something that we do. I mean, to try to incentivize, you know, cross-sector leadership, boundary-crossing leadership, and I think in the foundation we're doing that in the changes we made in our leadership training programs, our human capital programs, which is a now called Achieving Change Leadership. I think that the skill sets to collaborate, to understand how to cross disciplinary boundaries, how to work with people from very different walks of life toward a collaborative strategy is a major leadership skill needed in building a culture of health.
So,
yeah, and absolutely.
Let me give you a little general perspective on that. I agree very much that the partnerships have to be inherent and in many ways grassroots in terms of coming together. But money helps a lot. I think the funders have to do a much better job of identifying people that met each other outside the church. Mm-hmm. To go in and get the benefits, and making sure that the partnership is a true partnership. You know, I can tell you, we get lots of people who want letters of support from us, and they always want to give me $30,000 for, you know, $2 million worth of work. And we usually take the funding issue out of the discussion. We say, listen, we'll work with you. We'll figure out what this means. And this is even for, you know, even for people that we work with a lot, because it's usually about the relationship, and obviously there's funding implications behind that. But the relationship is very important. And while you can introduce people, it is very destructive to try to force them to work together. I don't think that works.
I think incentivizing, encouraging authentic partnerships, arranged marriages don't work as well in 21st century America. But I think strong incentive, because these problems cannot be solved without those disciplines. I think they would characterize our funding that we are encouraging, not forcing those kind of collaborations. I'm being told I probably have time for one more question.
You had your hand up.
I just want to follow up comment because I think it's really also important for funders to realize that it takes resources to be a backbone organization for social impact. And a lot of partnerships could be made more long-lasting, sustainable, and effective if the backbone organization was not just recognized but funded to be a really good backbone. So I think that's a critical piece to partnering and collaborations that we're starting to understand better and need to do more of.
Okay. That's great. Great comment. Oh.
The funding that we got was also important because it established a parameter.
Right.
It wasn't forcing, but you guys picked the one that said we're going to do a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the wife was part of it. It was very good.
Excellent.
So that helps us not go into the default mode of what we're going to do with nutrition class.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep, great. Excellent. Well, I want to thank the audience for some really terrific questions, and I want to thank the panel again for being a catalyst for those questions. Really terrific. I've got a couple of wrap-up things that I'm required to do. One is a shameless plug for a session I'm doing at 12:30 tomorrow to pick up on what they said about the data. The 12:30 session tomorrow is more about the data, the measures, measuring that matters, and how do we harmonize the kind of measurement thinking in the culture of health framework with other data sets that are out there, the IOM, the county health rankings that have been mentioned. So I encourage those of you who want to see that particular angle at the culture of health measures to consider attending. We're having foundation office hours at our booth, action framework office hours daily at 3 p.m. Come there, then the RAND and the youth and our staff will be there to talk about that with you. You can go more deeply. Again, look at cultureofhealth.org to go deeply into the action framework. And the last thing, before you leave today's session, please take a moment to talk to Mary Kay and Jessica Gosi. Where are you? They're out there. They are doing a little bit of survey. There's some concept systems, a really, really short survey around people attending. They really learn what you're thinking about a culture of health that will help us make this most relevant to all of you as we go forward. So keep conversing with us. Keep working with us. It's a really great opportunity to share with this today. Thank you. Bye.